Well, that last question shows, and I'd be very happy to discuss it more fully, that this teaching of Jesus that we've been looking at in the first session raises enormous difficulties and challenges for us as Christians, and specifically for, and I want to think particularly, if I may, of these people in the second lecture, for Christian leaders and ministers in churches today. How are we in practice to work out in our church life the implications of what we've been looking at from the teaching of Jesus? And I want to say that there are three areas, I want to talk about these three areas in this second lecture, where we need to be working in order to work out the implications of this policy. I'll try to make this second lecture half an hour so that we have a lot of time for questions at the end. So the first area I want to mention is the area of education. Now, I think that this is the hardest area of all, because three views are almost universal in our society today and are also widely accepted in the church. And I want to talk about those three views before I go on to think how we can counter them. First, it is very unfortunate to be single. In fact, if anything, I think that's more widely held in the church than in society. Second, a child needs a mother and an adult male in the house. Third, it is good for a divorcee to remarry. Now, I don't think I need to persuade you that those are three very, very widely held views in our society today. And I want to say that the first is unbiblical, the second is untrue to experience, and the third is both unbiblical and untrue to experience. So let me take them one by one. The first is, it is very unfortunate to be single. So you hear people say about a single woman, it's so sad, she's all on her own. Or to the divorcee, and this is so frequently how people try to comfort divorcees, don't worry, you'll soon find someone else. There are plenty of women who'll be interested in you. And if those of us who, I am married, but married comparatively late in life, if those of us who have known extended periods as an adult before any marriage, or perhaps never having married, know what it is like to have the pressure of your friends to push you into marriage in a way that they think is being kind and helpful to you, the divorcee knows that twice as much again. Now that attitude, the attitude that it's very unfortunate to be single, was precisely the attitude of the Jews of Jesus' day. And into this, the teaching of the New Testament exploded like a bombshell. The teaching, for example, of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, I haven't, in fact, here spoken, I've only culled from 1 Corinthians 7 those parts that are speaking about divorce and remarriage. But you'll know that 1 Corinthians 7 is about marriage and singleness, and most of all, about marriage, about singleness, rather. And it is the passage above all else which speaks of the positive blessings of singleness. I'm not going to look at it in detail now. But that passage is written off today. Many people say, oh, that was just St. Paul. He was a curmudgeonly old bachelor. No wonder he said that sort of thing. But that kind of response, you know, shows our prejudice is not his. And anyway, he is agreeing with and filling out the teaching of Jesus. Matthew 19, verses 10 to 12, the famous saying about eunuchs, is certainly primarily about singleness after divorce. But of course it has wider implications for all singleness. And there Jesus speaks about renouncing marriage or making yourselves eunuchs for the kingdom of God. Now the New Testament attitude in 1 Corinthians 7 particularly is summed up in this very remarkable statement, which is 1 Corinthians 7 verse 38. So that, I'm actually reading from the RSV here, but I'm sure the NIV is very similar, so that he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do better. Now that is a very remarkable statement, isn't it? Marriage is good, but singleness is better. And what a contrast with the contemporary attitude, it is very unfortunate to be single. Now here's the second attitude. A child needs a mother and an adult male in the house. No, all sociological research shows very clearly that a child, ideally at least, needs his or her mother and his father in the house. Not another adult male, but the father. He does need, or she does need, a male and a female, but not any old male and female. The greatest upset to a child is the separation or divorce of their parents. Often, not of course always, there are some exceptions, but far more often than not, the second greatest upset is the introduction into his home of another man. That is, assuming that he is living, in a case of separation or divorce, with his mum. Whether that man is his mum's live-in partner or his mum's new husband. Now, there are several reasons for this, but one of the chief reasons is that the introduction of a new male tends to cut him off more from his own dad. In other words, the situation clearly revealed in all research projects is that when the child is with, let us say, because I mean it works the other way if the custodial parent is the dad, but so much more frequently that the custodial parent is the mum, when the dad lives separately, he finds it hard enough to continue his relationship with his children. When a new man, either married or in a cohabiting relationship, moves in with his ex-wife, he finds it much, much harder to continue the relationship with his children. What is more, by far the single greatest strain in remarriage is the children of the first marriage, or marriages. In a remarriage situation, the tensions, there are all sorts of, I mean, of course there is in first marriages, but in second marriage there are all sorts of tensions. The greatest single tension is normally caused by the children that are brought into this blended family, as it's sometimes called, situation. So far from it being the case that a child needs a mother and an adult male in the house, a child needs let me put it like this, the closest possible relationship with his or her mother and father. And if you have the child's benefits at heart, you will do nothing which will dilute the relationship with, normally it's the father, the one who moves out. Thirdly, the third assumption, it is good for a divorcee to remarry. Now, it's fascinating to see how deeply rooted this is in the perception of people today, including Christians. Before I wrote my first book, I gathered together a number of people in our congregation who themselves were divorced or separated. Some of them remarried, some of them not. And over a period of 4 weeks, I'll say more about this later on, or four sessions, we had some tremendously in-depth discussions, and also they wrote a very considerable amount of material for me. And this was also in preparation for a series of sermons, which I preached. Again, I'll say more about that, on the subject of divorce and remarriage. I have recently begun writing a second book on the same subject, and I reconvened the group, but I also added one or two other people to that group. And one couple that I added to the group was a couple that had remarried. In fact, about their marriage took place about 10 days or a fortnight before the first session of this new group. Now, everybody in that new group knew my own understanding of the New Testament from the group that we'd been in before and from my sermons. A number of them had read my book. And to a greater or lesser extent, felt some sympathy with those views, some of them accepting them completely, others, you know, and the whole spectrum there present. At the beginning of the group, the second series of meetings, we introduced ourselves round, and this couple, who are members of our church but not particularly well known within it, mentioned that they had got married 10 days beforehand. The whole group erupted with congratulations. Because it's instinctive in us to do that. Even the very members of the group who actually themselves on biblical grounds would have felt that it was illegitimate smiled and said, "Great." That's how deeply rooted that response, "It's good to remarry," is. And yet statistically, in experience, it doesn't have a very good track record. At present, the statistics in our country are that around 40% of all current marriages will end in divorce. It's harder to get statistics for remarriage, but it is around 60% of all second marriages and subsequent marriages will end in divorce. So it isn't actually true in experience that it's particularly, overall, I mean, obviously there are exceptions, many exceptions, but taken as a whole, that it's been a particularly good experience for people to remarry. And much more important, of course, it is either in all circumstances or in most circumstances, depending on your understanding of the exception clause, forbidden by Christ. Now, why do I say that all at the beginning? Because we have got a hard and uphill battle to re-educate Christians, let alone society, about God's view of singleness, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. We're not playing on an easy wicket here. But nevertheless, if this is the teaching of Jesus and of his apostles, it is essential that we seek to go up that road to seek to re-educate the church and society. How do we do this? Well, I want to mention three areas under this heading. Firstly, we must tackle this in sermons. When I was in the United States, in the Anglican Church, United States, it's a rather more high church tradition. And it would be true, these things would be true about Anglican churches in the States. First, they would all use, almost all, I mean 90, 8-9% would use the lectionary. In other words, the set passages for any given Sunday. Secondly, almost all of them would have communion as their main service on a Sunday every week. And thirdly, almost all clergy would preach on the gospel rather than the epistle set for the day or the Old Testament passage every week. Okay? Now that makes for easy discussions about sermons for next Sunday when clergy meet together. And I had a group of evangelical clergy that met, a sort of book reading group, in the Diocese of Pittsburgh where I was serving. And we happened to meet one time when on the next Sunday, the passage that was set as the gospel passage for the day was the very passage in Mark 10 that we spent quite a lot of time looking at. So I went round the group and I said, what are you going to preach on this Sunday? And do you know, not a single other clergyman in the group was going to speak about divorce. Not a single one. Most of them said, oh, I'm going to speak about the importance of relationships. Perhaps they were going to speak about marriage. And one of them said, what for an Episcopalian in the United States is the counsel of despair. I'm going to preach on the Old Testament this week. In other words, duck it all together. But don't let's imagine that this is only true in the United States. I went the other day to a very reputable evangelical church in this country, and again, as it happened, in fact, they were preaching through Mark's Gospel in that case, and they came to this passage in Mark 10. It was exactly the same passage. And I gather that in that church, they normally preach for about 20 minutes or so. And that evening, the preacher began by saying, this is such a complex subject that I need to spend much longer. And he spoke for about 40 minutes on Mark 10. Now, in the entire sermon, he devoted, I think, 95% of his time to talking about divorce and just touched on remarriage for about 5 minutes at the end. Whereas if you look at Mark 10, it leads up to saying specifically in verses 11 and 12, which was part of his passage. The next week they were going on to verses 13 and so on. He was talking about remarriage. Now, it's very understandable. And I have found in the preaching that I have done on the subject in our own church extremely difficult. And I've had to face anger and questions, obviously, and we've had question times and so on afterwards. It's not been easy. And I've obviously, it's been had to be done with tremendous sensitivity, and I'm sure I haven't always been as sensitive as I should have done. But it seems to me that we simply cannot duck this in our preaching. We're really faced with two alternatives, aren't we? Either we say this is too hot to handle, in which case we leave the field entirely to secular opinion, or we face it head on. And it seems to me that to be faithful to Christ, that isn't an option. There's only the second option that's open to us. So we've got to preach on it. Secondly, we've got to speak to children about this. We've got to start at the youngest possible age. So in our series on, I think it was in the series, it might have been at a different time, on divorce and remarriage, we had a sermon on Genesis 2:24, the famous passage, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and so on, in the context of a family service. It happened that our monthly family service fell that time. Now, obviously, I'm not going to make a big deal of divorce and remarriage in that setting. But nevertheless, I felt it incumbent upon me, briefly, and again, I hope sensitively, in explaining what one flesh means, to say that marriage is not just ideally, but it is for life. We've got to be teaching this in our Sunday schools as well. Now, again, I'm very, very well aware of the difficulty in this, and I want to face two objections, which are brought up normally against teaching children. The first is people say children are too young. Don't let's make them old before their time. There'll be time enough as teenagers or whatever to face this question. Don't let's introduce the subject of divorce and remarriage when they're 3, 4, 5. That's an absolute nonsense. I live in an old-fashioned vicarage which is bang next door to our church. Now, for all that I have tried to teach our children, and so has my wife, about the value of singleness, our children are obsessed with marriage. And one of their favorite things is to, they're all girls, is to go into the church, and one of them will be just on a weekday, and one of them will be the vicar, and one will be the bride, and the others will be, there's never a bridegroom, I may say, because they don't want to be the man. They'll all be bridesmaids or a bride, and they'll have a marriage service. They're obsessed with the subject. And as far as divorce is concerned, my oldest is 7, and when she went to school at 4, I think in her first term, certainly in her first year, one of her classmates' parents split up during the course of the year. So to say that they are too young is a nonsense. They are meeting this in their daily lives and with their friends from a very, very young age. But how about the second question, that it's too sensitive a subject? And obviously this is difficult because we have within our Sunday school groups or within, obviously, a family service, for example, children of divorced parents. Now, certainly, this means that it needs sensitivity. And it's got to be handled with enormous care. And certainly, you don't want to undermine their relationship with their own parents and perhaps with step-parents as well. But far from for that reason sweeping it under the carpet, it needs to be brought out into the open. So often we think that where there is a divorce, the people who need counseling and help are the adults who are divorced or divorcing or separating. They do. But the children desperately need help as well. And they need the subject to be brought out into the open. So we have children in our choir. And I found that when we were preaching through divorce and remarriage, quite a number of the choir children came to me individually and said, please, can we talk this through more fully? And again, I don't necessarily say that I handled it in the very best way, but I think it's a very healthy thing that for those children with divorced parents, some adult was prepared to talk to them about it. And the public teaching opened the way to the private discussion. Incidentally, I want, if I may at this point particularly, to recommend two books on the subject of the effect on children. The most comprehensive study of the effect of divorce on children has been conducted by an American woman called Judith, I think she'd probably call herself Wallerstein, Wallerstein. And she has followed up a series of families after 18 months, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and so on. She's written so far 2 books on this very extensive research project. The first is called Surviving the Breakup, and the second is called Second Chances. I think they're both only available from the United States, but I warmly recommend them, secular books on the effect of divorce on children today. So we've talked about sermons in education, we've talked about children in education. Now I come on to marriage preparation. Very interesting to me that in the new government white paper on the proposed divorce reform changes, which Colin kindly gave me and I was reading on the way up, that the Lord Chancellor is now saying that the government has got to look into more careful marriage preparation. Interesting that, I think. that the government is recognizing that we, in order to prevent divorce, the government itself needs to get involved in helping more adequate marriage preparation to take place. And it's particular because obviously the principal providers of marriage preparation are actually the Christian churches in our society today. We need to introduce as part of the marriage preparation a full discussion of conflict resolution. In other words, fully acknowledging that conflict, including acute conflict, can enter into marriage, and how to seek to resolve that. And also to seek to introduce the view, the Christian view, that marriage is something which God does for a couple for life. And that therefore in God's eyes, when things get difficult, the dissolution of marriage through divorce is not an option. Now, I think we should have done this yet in our church, get into the situation, and it's only a small way, which actually the Episcopal Church does demand in the States for all its very inadequate view of remarriage, which is to ask a couple on getting married to sign a paper in which they acknowledge the permanence of the marriage relationship that they're entering into. Now, it's a very small thing in itself. But I think it's taking a leaf out of the Roman Catholics' book. You know how the Roman Catholics insist, or used to insist, that where a couple get married and one of the partner is not a Roman Catholic, but if they're to get married in a Roman Catholic church, they insist, or used to insist, that the children are brought up as Roman Catholics. Now, in my experience, many couples have regarded that signed paper as something which has been binding on them, even if they've disagreed with it. Now, it's a very small thing, but anything that we can do to help couples feel that this is something, to know that this is something that they've entered into for life, is something that we should encourage. Education. Second, pastoral care. One of the most devastating experiences that can happen to a person is the breakup of their marriage, arguably worse than bereavement, completely undermining, in most cases, of self-confidence and the ability to cope, especially, though not exclusively, since in most cases the church is in touch with the one who has been left. Normally, the one who does the leaving puts a long distance between himself or herself and the church. Normally, the person we are in touch with as churches is the one who has been left. And again, I want briefly to mention three ways in which I think, or three needs, pastoral needs, that the divorcee has. First, listeners. One or two people who will listen at any time of day or night, and who will listen to the same story over and over and over again. And that means, for those of us who are ministers, almost certainly not you. You haven't got the time to spend perhaps initially several hours each week listening to a person pouring out their troubles. Rather, a sensitive neighbor, a sensitive friend with lots of patience, who is genuinely prepared to listen at any time of day or night. Now, our job as Christian leaders may be to help make those connections, or to encourage the neighbor or the friend really to get in there and stick in there, and to support the neighbor or friend who's doing that. We have a series of what we call lay pastors, people from within the congregation who are set aside for pastoral work. And we have a particular couple within that whom we have specifically set aside as pastors for troubled marriages. And significantly, within that couple, one of the partners, the wife in fact, is the listener. Now, as it happens, I don't particularly belong to the school of thought which says that Christian counseling should take the form entirely of listening with hardly offering any advice at all. I don't believe that to be a particularly biblical approach to the offering of Christian counsel. But in this instance, particularly in the early years of, or certainly in the early months of separation or divorce, people do need to be trained to listen and not to offer advice. And very often the offering of advice can be counterproductive. So first, they need listeners. Second, and I know that these overlap, they need friends, or helpers, if you like. And specifically, people who don't wait to be asked, but who offer help. Mums, especially, often feel trapped with their children. They're cooped up in the house, they can't get out, they perhaps can't afford a babysitter, they can't be in a babysitting circle and offer to babysit for somebody else. And meanwhile, as they see it, their husband's off with some floozy. So they feel trapped. Dads can feel that there's no purpose left in their life. They've not only lost their wife, whom they may or may not be relieved to be free from, but they've lost their children as well. That's how it feels. And they're both of them, for different reasons and in different ways, in need of help. It's no good simply saying, oh, do call on me any time. They don't want to do that. They don't want to be, quote, parasites, many of them. Some, I mean, I'm generalizing. Some, of course, are willing, but perhaps not particularly happy to ask and ask and ask. But they need many, again, I'm generalizing, food. Great to have a dish prepared, transport, babysitters, DIY jobs done, to be included on a holiday or a social occasion. What's more, they need to be brought to church events. Many, many, many divorcees find it hard, even years later, to walk as a newly single person into a group which they perceive, probably wrongly if you did a demographical test, to be full of married couples. So they need someone to see. If they've got a car, shall I pick you up on the way? Now clearly this sort of help is more than one person can do. And therefore, ideally, they need something like a house group, which has been helped to understand the position that a divorced person finds themselves in, perhaps by reading that one of many, many books on the subject, and beginning to get into the shoes and acting accordingly. Third, I think that divorced people, many of them, need a supportive group. That is to say, and here I'm differentiating from the house group, a specialist group for the separated and divorced. Now we have one such group in the church. I want to explain to you how it came about, because I think although it quote-unquote happened, it was almost the ideal way for such a group to be formed. I mean, it wasn't intentionally so. As I mentioned to you, I was not only writing this book on divorce and remarriage, but also giving quite a long, I mean, the series of sermons was 15 or 16 long, and not just on divorce, on marriage and singleness and so on as well, and divorce and remarriage. And I gathered around me a group of these 10 or 12 people. We met in confidential but completely open discussion on four separate evenings, and in addition, on three occasions in the intervening weeks, they were asked a series of questions and asked to hand in written material. I have never known a group, I may say, that has been so conscientious about their homework. I've done a lot of training in my time. I got reams and reams and reams of material, quite a bit of it quoted with characters changed and so on in my book. But what happened was this. The group was there to help me. It was not there for me to teach them. It was there to help me. And that was a very positive thing, because they felt that they had something to offer me, which indeed they did. But they also found that as they thought about their own situation, their whole attitude began to change. So, for example, a man who'd been divorced for many years wrote in his first homework to me, after I mean, probably 10 or 12 pages long, he said, "I have understood for the first time that in my marriage breakup, it wasn't that my wife was 80% responsible and I was 20%, but that we were 50-50 responsible for the breakup of our marriage." Now that is a very, very significant insight. And it came as they were part of the group. Then what happened was this. At the end of the group, it was such a valuable experience for the people who were in the group that they said, "We cannot stop here." And they were open enough and in a way sorted out enough to say, not we must go on meeting, but we must allow other people to have this same opportunity. And so they began a group which we call Oasis, which has basically a 10-week course, I think it's about 10 weeks anyway, which is entirely run by people who are themselves separated or divorced, for the separated and divorced. Initially, for people from within our own church family, Crowborough at one stage quite recently had the highest divorce rate in the country, but now increasingly for people who are separated and divorced within the community. In fact, the majority now are non-church members. Specifically, this is for a time, and then the ideal is, whether they start as Christians or not, that they then get integrated with the rest of the church. Though, in fact, they're now beginning a once a month or once every 6 weeks sort of follow-on group for those who want to come. And they're beginning to organize other things. For example, they've just come back, only about 3 weeks ago, from an enormous great holiday in France, organized by this group, mainly for this group, but also incorporating some people with so-called intact marriages and families. Pastoral care. Now I hurry swiftly on and move to my third area of reconciliation. I don't think we can stress enough that the gospel, the Christian good news, is all about reconciliation. It's about reconciling people to God and about reconciling people to each other. And therefore, it seems to me we should be in no doubt that our primary desire and prayer and work, even if that may not be ostensibly the case and completely out front, as it were, is to help couples be reconciled. And I want to mention this in two areas. Firstly, where the marriage is in difficulties. It is still there, the husband and wife are still living together, or at least it's before the divorce, but it's in difficulties. What do you do when someone says, in the course of conversation, they're talking about this, that, and the other, you know, they say they're tired and the children aren't behaving very well and this and that and the other, and they just add, "And things between Richard and me aren't all that easy at the moment either." Now what do you do when they let that drop? See, it's easy to look sympathetic and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Or to be a bit embarrassed. Or to feel you don't know what to say. And I want to encourage us all to pick that up and to take it further. In other words, to come in with at least listening and perhaps some help earlier, rather than leaving it until things have got worse still. most people go to marriage guidance in some way when it's far too late. But they've probably dropped some hints to their friends beforehand. So, for example, I had a situation the other day where a woman came up to me, as quite frequently happens, "I'd love to have a chat with you sometime." And it so happened that we'd been up to London, a group of us, to a museum, to the National Gallery, in fact, and it happened that I was coming back on the train with her. We were going back earlier than the others. And so to turn to her, might have been a couple of months on, because she hadn't taken me up on it, and said, "You said you wanted to chat to me sometime about something. What was that about?" And so to her surprise, and in a railway carriage, fortunately not a very full one, she began telling me at first a little bit reluctantly and then more and more fully about the relationship with her husband. We talked a lot then, and then fixed up for her to come and talk to my wife and me. And now really I'm at the stage where I need to visit her again to follow up that discussion. Again, the establishment within our church of lay pastors with a specific and known responsibility for caring for marriages in difficulty has been a valuable thing. You and sensitive lay people are just as likely to be helpful as relate, and anyway are essential in addition to relate or whatever other marriage guidance there is. It's essential that friends back up the process of helping troubled marriages. So when the marriage is in difficulties, and secondly, when the marriages are split up. Now, it's very difficult where there's been a separation, still more difficult where there's been a divorce. But in most circumstances, in most situations, there is, or in many, there is a window of opportunity. There's a time when the couple are actually open to that possibility. So I think of a couple in our own congregation who divorced, separated, then divorced. The wife had an affair, actually had a child by the new relationship. And then that relationship began to unravel. And at that moment, there was a window of opportunity to think that maybe it wasn't so bad with her husband after all. They had continuing relations with each other through the children. They began to get together again. And they've now formally and legally remarried. And our responsibility is to seek to see when that window of opportunity may be. And admittedly, it's got to be very delicate, because it must be their decision. And if we seek to force a decision, it's almost certain to be counterproductive. But we need to help them if they're beginning to see that or to consider that possibility. The problem is that very often the partner who is thinking it might be possible imagines that the other partner will reject. Furthermore, and it ties in with what I was saying to you, full reconciliation may not be possible, and indeed in most cases will not be possible. But what we want to seek to bring to each couple is the measure of reconciliation that is possible. That is not only the biblical position, that as far as possible we are to be reconciled with each other, but it will also be enormously helpful to the people we counsel or we befriend. One of the most terrible effects of divorce is the bitterness that often becomes deeply rooted in the lives of at least one partner, normally the partner who's been left. And anything that we can do to help aid understanding, forgiveness, and a measure of reconciliation will be a wonderful blessing to both partners involved. And we need never to give up. There's a couple in our congregation at the moment, both of them members, divorced, neither of them remarried. And I have sought again and again at different times, I say again and again, probably two or three times in the last 5 years, to ask them whether they would consider seeking to move together. And so far they've always said no. And that may continue to be the case. But in my prayers and in seeking those windows of opportunity, I feel I'm never able to give up. I want to mention two books specifically on the subject of reconciliation. They're both American. One I have brought some copies of, which you could buy if you wanted to, and that's by Gary Chapman. It's called Hope for the Separated. That deals particularly with the period between separation and before divorce, although a lot of what he says would be applicable after divorce. The other book, I'm not sure is still in print, even in the States, is by Jim Talley. It's called Reconcilable Differences. And it speaks more about the measure of reconciliation that is possible, not necessarily full reconciliation. The other difference is that the Chapman book speaks to the partner who would like to be reconciled. The Talley book speaks to the partner who really is pretty reluctant to be reconciled in any measure. And why are we involved in this work of reconciliation, which is extremely hard? Because it's God's will that men and women be reconciled to each other, and because no couple or situation is impossible with God. We are in the business as Christians of building and of restoring marriages, because marriage was God's idea in the first place, and because God is committed to the permanent union of husbands and wives. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't manage half past at all. But questions from you. Yes, sir.
I notice here on verse 11, not everyone can accept this word.
Right.
Do you think that is applicable to, well, it is applicable to the population in general? And because we attempt to insist that we ought to be marrying people willy-nilly, that we put ourselves in one terrible mess. I mean, as one who's had classroom experience, it's quite disconcerting to find youngsters when you discuss sexual relationships and marriage and what have you, for most of them to say they do not expect their marriage to be permanent. Mm. They've already decided that. Mm. We seem, therefore, to, we've got to take realistic attitudes about the social and moral conditions in which we live. Would it not be well for us to advocate that every one of us should henceforth have a civil marriage? And if we desire to accept this word and prepare to live by it, then we come to church to be married in a Christian manner.
Right.
Our commitment is made. It does seem to me that, I mean, you've referred to the failure of the church to properly educate people for marriage. And funny enough, I was thinking about this week. Equally, we ought to be in a position to say, I'm sorry, but I cannot marry you. Mm. Because you can't fulfill those conditions. And we're not saying that. And we're getting ourselves in a terrible mess.
Right. It's a difficult one, that. I understand exactly what you're saying. I have once in my life refused to marry a couple, because I thought that the prospects for their marriage lasting were so desperate that I felt I really could not be party to the marriage. And as it happened, their marriage broke up within about 10 days, I think, of their getting married.
But that's made a fool of you.
I didn't take the wedding.
No, but you know what I mean.
But yes, I mean, in a way, I mean, it was taken by my boss, in fact. So I know what you mean. But having said that, I don't want to do that. And the reason I don't want to do that is this. Twofold, really. Negatively, or if it is negatively, I don't want to say anything different about a civil marriage from what I say about a church marriage. The couple married in a registry office are no less married, no less one flesh, no less joined together by God than the couple married in church. And if I were to say, well, if you get married in church, then there is a greater commitment to permanence on you, I would, as a corollary of that, be saying, if you get married in a registry office, then you can sit a little looser to marriage. And I don't want to say that. I don't want to even be seen to be saying that. So that's why I wouldn't go for that. The second reason is, I mean, obviously within an Anglican situation, the majority of people we marry are not Christians. And we do at least have an opportunity to try to teach a Christian view of marriage, included within that, the permanence of the marriage relationship. So I don't really want to shut the door of marriage. And I don't have a difficulty about it either. It's different from baptism, where I have all sorts of difficulties. Because we're not actually asking them. We are asking them to make a commitment to permanence. The marriage service is shot through with that. But we're not asking them to make a specifically Christian commitment in the marriage service.
Yes.
Just going back to your first lecture, what ceremonial aspects of marriage would you feel are necessary to take place before God would join a couple together?
Right, okay, well that's it. It was asked me in the break. Let me simply say this. I think that the biblical position is that whatever makes a man and woman married in the eyes of it would normally be the contemporary law of the state which the couple live in, or in a pre-organized society, in the society, the accepted way in which you get married, is recognized by God. In other words, God is neutral as to the ceremonial, to use your language, that is involved. For example, in the Old Testament, as far as we can reconstitute it, it was very simple. We find that Isaac meets Rebecca and simply takes her into his tent. Now, very clearly, in the context, that does not just mean he thought, this is a nice one, you know, and let's have intercourse. It was a very specific taking her into his family in a formal way. But there seems to be no ceremonial other than that, and no religious ceremony specifically, that we are aware of anyway. So as far as we can reconstitute it, the biblical position, it's certainly been the church's position down the age, is that the church acknowledges the law of the land as to how a couple get married. But two elements have normally been considered, and they certainly are in this country, to be essential in this. One is the consent of both parties. That's why a couple say, I will, or I do, whatever it is at the beginning of a marriage ceremony. That it must be voluntary rather than coerced. And the second is that there must be some public element to it. It must be something which is publicly done. A public transaction takes place. And in that sense, you can't go to bed one night unmarried and wake up the next night morning and find that, oh, I'm married.
Could you say briefly what your position is?
is on remarrying divorced people. You sort of slightly alluded to it. I took from what you said that you had no problems with remarrying divorced people. Then presumably you would distinguish between Christians and non-Christians.
No, I'm sorry. I obviously haven't made myself clear all morning, if you think that. I would not ever feel able to remarry people where there's been a divorce, nor do I feel able to conduct a service of blessing, because it seems to me that that is actually asking the church to say yes to this marriage or remarriage at the outset. And incidentally, the populace at large finds it, in my experience, very difficult to distinguish in any case between a remarriage and a service of blessing. Many people consider that the church is remarrying them. So no, I don't feel able to do that. Yeah, I probably...
Well, that was the only point I misunderstood. I understood
right.
The rest of it.
Good, okay.
Just Mike.
You mentioned in answering the earlier question about there should be some sort of ceremony or whatever
right.
Is culturally accepted. Where does the sexual side come into it, in that if you have a couple who live together,
right.
I had always thought that the sort of one flesh was had a sexual element.
Right.
Are they married even though there's been no ceremonial?
Right. No, they're clearly not, I would want to say. And I would want to say that both from the Old and the New Testament. In the Old Testament, the situation was that where a couple slept together, if they were neither of them married, they should marry. But the Old Testament clearly envisages, A, that they are not married already, but that they should subsequently marry, and B, that the father of the woman can refuse, can actually say, I don't want this to take place. So, as it were, the decent thing to do is to marry, but they are not married. In the New Testament, I think it's very interesting, this, and I think it's worth turning to, and there, when we'll finish on that. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. In 1 Corinthians 6, and again, forgive me, I use more readily the RSV, because I know where everything is in that. But I'm sure the RSV and NIV know different if you've got that. 1 Corinthians 6, Paul seems, from verse 12, to be answering a question which they've raised with him. All things are lawful for me seems to be a quote from them, and he responds, but not all things are helpful. And he applies this, perhaps because they did, partly to food, verse 13. But then he goes on to talk about sexual intercourse, particularly with a prostitute. And he says, verse 15, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I therefore take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who joins himself to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two shall become one flesh. Now, that would seem to be saying exactly your point, that sexual intercourse creates a marriage bond. But no, what is quite clear is that it creates a bond, and a bond which can be described as becoming one flesh, but not a marriage bond. And specifically, he says in verse 18, shun or flee immorality. So in this situation, where you have actually joined to a prostitute, he says, get out of that relationship as quick as you possibly can. Now, it's impossible that St. Paul would say that about a relationship that is a marriage relationship. So what he is saying is, yes, what interestingly 20th century psychologists have shown to be the case, namely that there is no such thing as purely casual sex. You cannot simply go to bed with a woman or a man and do something which is a purely physical act, which has nothing whatsoever to do with your personalities. On the contrary, you, as it were, leave something of yourself in that relationship. And he is even prepared to quote Genesis 2:24 on the subject. Nevertheless, rather than saying, therefore, then regularize the situation with the prostitute, he actually says, get out of it as fast as you can. So sexual intercourse alone does not constitute marriage, even a continuing such relationship. Nevertheless, of course, sexual intercourse is an essential part of marriage. And in fact, 1 Corinthians 7 goes on to talk about that in the very first verses.